Columbus State Community College is a place that changes lives. A college that opens doors to well-paid careers in healthcare, engineering, IT, and more. An affordable college that offers the flexibility to balance work, family, and school. An open, supportive college where more than 40,000 students every year get education to improve their lives. Columbus State, the smart choice for what's next. Spring semester starts January 19th. Apply today at cscc.edu.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's find a conversation between your soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads. Welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today the other Daniel Penny. This one is Daniel Waite Penny, and he is a journalist, critic, editor, and the co-host of Carbon Bros, a crossover mini-season from Drilled and Non-Toxic that digs really deeply into the manosphere. So, Daniel, first of all, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk to you guys.
So one of the things I wanted to ask is what made you want to devote time to really digging into the manosphere, you know, that great space that everyone just can't get enough of. And why do you think this is an important topic, a topic that's worthy of spending your intellectual energy on over a period of time?
Yeah, sure. I think it's kind of a circuitous road that led me there. I suppose that's the case for anyone who winds up in the manosphere, either sucked into it or studying it. It's rarely a straight line. But if I were to give the quick version, it was basically that I was writing for some men's magazines and feeling like the stories I wanted to tell were just not getting picked up by my editors, who thought that there just wasn't interest. And I was pretty convinced that actually these were things worth talking about. So I just started my own podcast, Non-Toxic. But specifically, it's not just the manosphere. I was interested in the way that the manosphere and climate denial seem to be increasingly intertwined. And that was kind of the start of what I did with Non-Toxic. And then Amy came along and we paired up to do Carbon Bros. And definitely feel like I've leveled up a bit with the quality of the show. I'm very happy with
well, partner. You're leveling down right now, so apologies in advance. Where did this come from? Because there's a ton of different sources of the manosphere, but why did it emerge then it did? The one that I generally link it to in terms of proximate cause is obviously Gamergate, but I feel like a lot of these issues were percolating for a longer time.
Sure.
So where do you identify the source of the manosphere, and what are the particular grievances?
Yeah.
It seems to be, a grievance-led, quote-unquote, movement.
Absolutely.
Not really a movement, but you know what I mean, that led to it.
I mean, it is a social movement. It does, or at least corners of the manosphere see themselves as being part of a social movement or a political project. I would say, you could look back at Susan Faludi's Backlash, which is a great book about the 80s and the origins of the kind of anti-feminist popular culture that really came out against the women's liberation movement. And that took a lot of different forms. That to me is like a very useful starting point. Even though it's pre-internet, it sets up a lot of the terms and introduces a lot of the ideas that we would come to see in the manosphere. So you have things like dads who are getting divorced and are fighting about child custody and this idea of like parental alienation syndrome. Like that's one corner of it, is like dads' rights and feeling like, you know, their bitch wives are stealing their children and turning them against them, you know, like that kind of discourse.
Sure. Just to clarify, this is a pro-wife podcast.
I'm a wife
clear.
Guy myself. I'm
just, we're wife men, but yeah, that's cool.
just trying to channel that thinking. And then,
of course,
there were also, you know, like other strands that were more kind of like pickup artistry, you know, what we think of, and that really kind of develops in the 90s. And, you know, think of like Magnolia, that movie with Tom Cruise. So there were kind of multiple different grievances about the changes, the social changes, economic changes, political changes that women's liberation had brought about. And yeah, I think they came together as like a political force with Gamergate for sure. Like that's like the millennial version. But we've seen other moments in recent American history where there have been self-conscious kind of attacks against the progress that women and LGBTQ people and anyone who like challenges masculinity as such, you know, those, there have always been resistance. There's always been resistance to those people.
Of course,
and
the going
movements
back,
that they lead. So we're living through a particularly strong period of resistance right now.
So then the question that I have is why? So, you know, we're Marxists here and we generally point to political economic sources of a lot of these issues, even though obviously the economic base and the political, ideological, cultural, social superstructure interact in actual history. I was just wondering if there is a political cause from here. Is this the result of deindustrialization? Is this the result of the fact that it's much more difficult to quote-unquote be a breadwinner in the 1950s imagination of what it means to be a man, which is obviously linked to Donald Trump and the MAGA movement? Is this a result of the increasing economic stratification of American society and people sort of channel these resentments in particular directions? Like I would say QAnon is clearly, obviously not as powerful, but that was clearly a reaction to the increasing degradation of American life. I think that people are only open to conspiracy theory when things are bad in their lives. The happy people generally don't embrace conspiracy theory. I think that's generally true. So what do you would say, there's this ideological thing that's happening, which is this reaction to feminism in the first, second, third, fourth waves. But is there, I don't want to use the word deeper, but I'll just use it here because I think they both operate, but a quote unquote deeper source of these resentments?
Yes, I would say economics has got to be a key part of it. We talk about breadwinner masculinity in the show, and the link between breadwinner masculinity and fossil fuel consumption, because fossil fuels are kind of at the core of the creation of like the Fordist, like single family house with just like the dad going to work and driving the two cars. Like so much of what we think of as this vision of traditional masculinity and the things that a lot of these figures on the far right or on the manosphere are hearkening back to, like all of that is kind of premised on a specific economic and also like energy relationship that I think has come undone, or in the case of fossil fuels, like really needs to come undone. As to like why feminism is being blamed for so many men's economic losses, I think it's like a convenient scapegoat, right? I mean, it's not the only thing that's blamed. You see DEI, you know, there's like a new boogeyman every year or two, trans people, critical race theory, right? So like the right has to constantly invent new enemies to get people upset about so that they can distract from like the fundamental inequalities of our society. I think in the case of Carbon Bros, we really focus on the way that the climate movement has been sort of beaten back and linked to feminism and other kind of ideas that challenge masculinity, and the particular attacks that have come from the fossil fuel funded groups. That's been interesting, but you see that kind of across other areas of our cultural conversation or our political debate.
Let's talk about the three horsemen of the manosphere: Joe Rogan, Andrew Tate, and Jordan Peterson. And it's interesting. I'm curious because I'm not sure I would classify Rogan in the same way that I would Tate and Peterson. I actually think Rogan occupies quite a different space than either of those people, which explains his much broader appeal and I think his much more lasting appeal. So I'm curious to see how you identify each of them and why you consider them to be these three major figures.
Sure. Well, Rogan is kind of the entry point of the funnel, I would say. He, as you mentioned, he has the broadest reach. He is someone who doesn't really have a coherent ideology, but he has certain ideas that he likes to repeat about the virtues of strength and masculinity and how men should be men. And he's against anything that he views as a kind of tempering force that would, you know, tell him what he can or can't do. And that idea of like wanting to like own the libs or like not be offended or not be told what to do, like that's, I would say it's almost like it's ideological. It's like emotional. It's temperamental. It's not really like on the level of thought, but it's an important element of the appeal of the manosphere. And it's kind of like the first step is like someone tells you like, hey, you shouldn't say that, or you know, we don't treat women that way in this and like that kind of initial defensiveness, or like, well, screw that, like actually I should, you know, double down and kind of go the opposite way. Like, I think Rogan really made that appealing and cool and edgy. And, you know, he's physically strong. He talks about, like, he's connected to all of these hobbies that are theoretically non-political, but have become vectors of our politics and are often very violent, right? Like, his association with the UFC, which is, you know, Trump's promising to have a UFC fight on the lawn of the White House. I mean, it doesn't get kind of more caveman than that. So yeah, Rogan, I think he doesn't always have a coherent thought about the relationship between men and women or kind of how women should be subservient or anything like that. But he has all these other guys on his show. And then like algorithmically drives you deeper and deeper into this place. Especially Jordan Peterson, like they have a long history together. Rogan's had him on his show many times. He quotes him all the time. They appear in the same events. Tate is a little bit different because he's kind of the boogeyman of the manosphere, I think. He is someone who they all love to hold up as someone that they aren't. And he's very useful as a foil to say like, hey, I'm not like abducting girls and keeping them in the sex dungeon in Romania. I'm a good guy. I'm a gentleman. Like, so they would never like include him amongst themselves. But the ideas that he formulates about, you know, the importance of strength and hustle and grind set and being an alpha, like these are all the same ideas that are repeated to among like other manosphere figures. So I think it has more to do with like the kind of level of degradation and exploitation that he engages in that makes him distasteful, but it's not really so much about like what he thinks so much as how he appears. It's an optics issue.
And how do you, what is the actual ideology that these guys are expressing? If they're a political movement, what is the idea? This is why, They seem looser than a political move. They seem to be more of a I hate to use this word, but a vibe or an affect, that there's like this affective appeal of them in what people imagine as an increasingly feminized era, which I mean, I don't actually buy. I think a lot of this, I mean, in terms of feminine being in relation to women, I think a lot of this is actually a reaction to like the emergence of a service economy and financialization and things along those lines. But what is the actual ideology of these people? Is there a coherent thing there? If people imagine themselves as part of a political movement, what is exactly this political movement trying to express?
Well, I would say, you know, no political movement is monolithic, right? If you look at like the civil rights movement, like there were different ideas about how civil rights would be achieved, under what conditions, to what, you know.
But there was a notion about civil rights.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's a spectrum, I would say. So on the kind of the Rogan era is just like men can't say what they want anymore, and like, you know, people don't want to let men be men, and we should do that, right? Which seems like kind of harmless. And
do we actually have statistics on the gender divide between who listens? I mean, Tate, I imagine, is 98% women. Peterson, I imagine, similarly. Rogan, I wonder if there's more of a split there, but I mean he's just so popular that I wonder if it's like 70-30 as opposed to 90-10. Do we actually know? Or
I don't have those stats to hand.
Yeah. I doubt he releases those, but I'd be curious to know, yeah.
But I know that in terms of who's sharing the content and who like the clips are targeted to, it is young men. So like if you go on TikTok or Instagram, if you are, you know, a young man, 14 to 30 something or whatever, like you're going to be fed those clips. So that's certainly the like intended audience. And it's certainly who is forced to interact with that content outside of just like listening to a whole episode. I think that's important to keep in mind with all of this stuff. It's not just people who go and actively seek out the 3-hour Joe Rogan experience. It's you're constantly assaulted with just these like bits of Rogan and bits of Peterson and Andrew Tate. And if you're just existing online, like you're going to encounter them. In terms of like what the manosphere wants, I think they all imagine like a golden age. They have different ideas of which age they want to go back to. In terms of when men were men and their relationship to women and kind of what the right version of masculinity is. So there are definitely a kind of like 1950s Leave It to Beaver. Often they have like a Christian nationalist tinge, you know, like you could think of like Pete Hegseth as an example of that, you know, who recently shared this far right pastor saying that like women shouldn't have the right to vote. So I think that like there's that kind of version. There's also this like, I mean, I think for Tate, it's this almost like social Darwinism. Like he wouldn't use that term, but it's this idea of like survival of the fittest, like we, you know, almost like eugenics kind of stuff of, you know, turn of the 20th century. That's probably his ideal time period where there were like no restrictions on what you could do. If you were like a rich guy, you could just like kind of operate totally freely. No income tax, no, you know, like that kind of vision of just being like a purely sovereign individual who could act however he saw fit and wasn't really held back by anyone. And then, yeah, others, I mean, there was like, was it Bronze Age? What was that guy called who was popular in the
Bronze Age pervert.
Yeah, thank you.
I cannot tell you how distressing it is to me that I knew who you were talking about.
Yes, Bronze Age pervert. So, I mean, some of these guys want to go all the way back to antiquity. And obviously they have deeply flawed ideas of what men were like in antiquity, because most of them haven't read any of the classics. They just read like AI summaries of them or something. But, you know, that's the idea, is always to go backward, but they don't agree on when we should go back to. And I think that's not really a problem from their point of view, because any reversal of the gains that women and LGBTQ people have made is a plus for them. And I think, you know, ideological consistency is something like the left is obsessed with. And like the right has never cared about ideological consistency. Like they're very happy to have people who are just kind of strange bedfellows because they share a common goal. And it doesn't matter whether or not you are a Christian or like complete libertine or, you know, a kind of eugenicist. Like they don't care as long as it's achieving their ends.
So let's rope in the other piece of this. How does this all come to be a part of the climate denial movement? And to what extent is that sort of organic? Like, do we have Andrew Tate saying things of his own volition about solar panels or wind, you know, whatever? And how much of it is cultivated by fossil fuel companies trying to portray this idea that, you know, burning coal is the manliest thing you can do, and it's just great for men. Where's the divide there between something that emerges and something that's being astroturfed?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's definitely both. In the case of someone like Andrew Tate, this was kind of the origin of my podcast, Non-Toxic. Actually, was, I don't know if you remember when Andrew Tate and Greta Thunberg were beefing online, and Andrew Tate had this video where he was like, look at my collection of gas guzzling cars, Greta, doesn't that just trigger you? Like, aren't you just triggered by this? And then she sent him a message about like, yeah, why don't you send me your collection at like ihaveasmallpenis@gmail.com. I forget exactly like what the, you know, but it was quite funny. And then he released a video of himself where he was trying to like rebut her, like get back at her. And It was shortly before he was arrested on sexual and sex trafficking charges. And there was this whole theory that there was like this pizza box in his video that accidentally revealed his location and the police were able to. And that theory, I think, has mostly been debunked. But I just, when I saw that, I was like, wow, it's all here. Like, this is this is everything. And so like his, in the case of Tate, I don't think anyone's paying him. Like, he's, you know, to use the favorite phrase, he's his brand is toxic, right? No company is going to be like, oh, you know who's a great influencer that we need to associate with? Andrew Tate. No. But others very much are funded by, you know, fossil fuel interests, like the Daily Wire, you know, which puts out Jordan Peterson's show, Ben Shapiro. That is funded by like the Wilkes brothers, among others. And the Wilkes brothers are two fracking far-right Christian billionaires in Texas who are extremely active in funding various kind of like manosphere adjacent figures, anti-trans legislation. Like, they've got their hands in a million different pots. I mean, going back further, the Koch brothers funded a lot of things that became part of the manosphere. I would certainly count Charlie Kirk among them, the master debater. And they recognize that these guys, one, like, they're willing to kind of insert whatever bullshit into their talking points. Like, they don't really have any compunction repeating fossil fuel disinformation, and they want to get that cash. It's way more profitable, as you guys know well, to be a right-wing talking head than a left-wing talking head. And then I think,
how dare you? How dare you impugn our business here?
Yeah, sorry, you guys just don't have that grind set.
No, we don't have that. We have too much grind set. We do too many goddamn episodes. Too.
Like, you can be Charlie Kirk, Charlie fucking Kirk, or Ben Shapiro, and be held up as like a masculine, like a symbol of masculinity. Like, it's just, you're playing on easy mode. Like, come on, man.
Yeah. I think the Hoover Institute just put out a call for historians, and like the base pay was $165K and had like no teaching responsibilities. So yeah, it is easier.
Just write op-eds, baby.
I think so. Yeah, there is a ton of fossil fuel money that's just like sloshing around this space, and they come together in the same place. Like Jordan Peterson's ARC conference, which happened in London a few months ago, that brought together all of these different figures across the far right, and among them fossil fuel interests, but also, you know, people like Michael Schellenberger, who's an interesting kind of climate skeptic, who went from darling of the left to heterodox to now like very much a man of the right, and who has, interestingly, he's gone from being a climate person to a manosphere person. So it goes both ways. It's not just manosphere figures who are adopting climate denying talking points and hosting climate deniers on their shows, but it's also then like climate people who are starting to dabble in manosphere talking points.
Columbus State Community College is a place that changes lives, a college that opens doors to well-paid careers in healthcare, engineering, IT, and more, an affordable college that offers the flexibility to balance work, family, and school. Spring semester starts January 19th. Apply today at cscc.edu.
So what, in your analysis, makes the Manosphere people susceptible to this? We already talked about what made them susceptible to manosphere politics. What makes them susceptible to this?
To climate denial.
Peculiar, you know, climate denialism.
These are the people who aren't being paid to do it. The people who just kind of get
the people
into
who
it.
Sure.
Believe.
So, like, what is the true like, believers. Why is this an appealing ideology, right? or set of talking
things.
Points?
Yeah.
Well, I think climate is pretty similar in a lot of ways to COVID in terms of the relationship between, like, government, science, idea of like restrictions on your personal liberty, and sort of there being a conspiracy. So oftentimes you'll hear people talk about like the climate hoax and how it's all a conspiracy that the government's doing to take away your, you know, ability to either burn the fuels that you want to burn, or they're going to take away your hamburgers. Like Fox, I remember, was obsessed with that one summer. A lot of people feel like the things that they enjoy, their lives are tied up with fossil fuels, and that it's a power grab by some evil, malicious actors who are trying to take away those symbols of what their life is. I think also, you know, people have listened to a lot of fossil fuel disinformation for decades now. We've been stuck with it since the late 80s. And it's pretty effective. Like, I don't know if you are familiar with that show, Landman, but there was a pretty...
We are familiar with the Landman. I'm an airman and Derek's a seaman, but we do know the Landman.
So yeah, Billy Bob Thornton had this like bizarre monologue.
How did I get to be this... Okay.
That was a conscious choice, Derek.
Billy Bob Thornton had this bizarre monologue in this otherwise kind of like normal episode of the show where he just like goes off about like how horrible wind turbines are and how like they'll never make back like the carbon used to even make them in the first place. And they're all just like a scam. And like, so people are just like, we're swimming in this stuff. And so you don't have to be part of the manosphere necessarily to be repeating climate denying talking points. But then I think like, you know, why it's particularly appealing to manosphere folks, it's, you know, fossil fuels are key to our idea of like power, strength, and virility. And we've been tying those things together symbolically for years. Remember that like Simpsons episode, Canyon Arrow? You know, this is something that we have been living with in the US and around the world for a long time, where fossil fuels are an important part of what it means to be a man. And if you're fixated on masculinity, and especially this idea of like a traditional 20th century masculinity, you know, that's premised on fossil fuels. Like, gotta have a big car to show you're a big man, or a big truck, right? You gotta have like the truck nuts on the back, you know. I mean, for some people, it's even like takes on a perverse element, like rolling coal, where you modify your diesel truck to spew toxic fumes and make it like less fuel efficient because you just like hate those environmentalists who are telling you what to do, or like those stupid libs riding their bikes or, you know, driving their hybrids. And it, yeah, it becomes a kind of symbol of defiance and resistance to all of the different things that are taking away the life that you think you should be leading and that you were promised. It's obviously a mistake. It's one that is, you know, deeply misinformed, but I think it makes sense if you accept certain premises and you don't think too hard.
How does Elon Musk fit into all of this? Because here's a guy who has decided to glom onto the right and put himself out there as a, again, another ridiculous symbol of masculinity. And yet, you know, he made his money and still does make most of his money selling electric cars.
Yeah.
So what is the, and people, you know, people in this, you know, the manosphere seem to love him, and yet they're, you know, out there sucking the exhaust out of their pickup truck because it owns the libs. Like, how does that dynamic work?
That's a great question. I think Elon Musk he's always been hard to pin down. He represents to me, or he's part of this part of the manosphere that does admit that climate change is real. Not everyone in the manosphere is a climate denier. Some of them are climate delayers. Some of them are climate doomers. And I would count Elon in like the doomer camp, because really he's not interested in like saving the planet through electrification. Exactly. He wants to create a colony on Mars.
Yeah, he wants to go to space.
Like Mark Andreessen or Peter Thiel, like, these guys all think that like we're cooked here, and they want to leave Earth and start their own kind of like techno-feudal space colony, and with them as kind of kings, right? So I think for them, it's...
But should that not be a giant red flag? Like, if you're the average Joe Rogan listener, or if you're like, you know, following Andrew Tate on Instagram, you're not going to get to go to Mars. You're not going to be one of the select who gets to fucking go on the rocket. Like, this should be a huge red flag to people that something's not right about this guy.
Yeah, you'd think so. But, you know, who is it that said, like, America is a nation of temporarily embarrassed millionaires? I think we're so easily suckered by these sorts of figures who are kind of brash and who live out our fantasies of doing what they want, saying what they want, and, you know, have the myth of meritocracy around them. Like, well, I just kind of like through my genius and hard work created this thing, and like you can too, and you should, you know, follow me, and maybe you can be like me. I mean, that's the promise that Andrew Tate makes. I think that's the promise implicitly that Elon Musk makes very often. You know, that's the grind set part of the manosphere that you need to embrace, Derek.
Yeah, you're right. I have to work on this. Yeah, you're right.
Daniel,
you're
right. I'm always telling him that he needs to do this. One of the things that I want to talk about, and I think is really interesting, is the way you talk about how environmentalism used to be coded as masculine. I mean, the most masculine, quote unquote, presidents of the 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt, ever, was Teddy Roosevelt, famously founder of the national parks, famously also the strenuous life and the importance of masculine triumph as key to American imperialism. What happened over the course of the 20th century that we arrive to a moment when environmentalism is coded as, you say, femme? You go from butch to femme. How does that happen precisely? Oh, one more. Sorry, just one more thing I want to add. This was also a characteristic of the fascist movements as well. Like the Wandervogel, the Wanderbirds of Germany, were very much about like returning to the land. And of course, the famous romantic photo is that guy with the sword standing over the cliff, you know, which obviously gets appropriated by the Nazis in particular in the 20th century. So this is something that you see across early to mid 20th century reactionary conservative movements, a sort of embrace of environmentalism, the need to protect the land from the degradations of industrialism is like key to reactionary politics. Sorry to interrupt.
Absolutely. I would say when Teddy Roosevelt comes on the scene, it's not accidental that a lot of his environmental ideas, like these are coinciding with a so-called crisis in masculinity in America, where a lot of, you know, pundits and newspaper writers and public people are worrying about the state of young men who are not fit and who, you know, especially in cities, they're getting into crime, they're becoming degraded, they're not manly. And so Roosevelt was really kind of combining like two things in one, where it was, you know, this idea of like the Boy Scouts and the strenuous life, like the solution to the problem of young men was to bring them to the outdoors and the...
And just very quickly, Daniel, this is all stuff about the Panic of 1893. I mean, there's this gigantic economic crisis in the early 1890s, very similar to 2008, where there's this like crisis of capitalism. Oh, wow. Shock among shocks. 10 years later, there's a crisis of masculinity. Sorry.
Yeah, because there are all these unemployed, kind of shiftless young men and teens. And... you know, they framed this as like a moral problem that could be solved through physical exercise and a return to nature, because the problems were in the city. So that was where it was located, if we take them out of the city. And the idea was that nature was a wilderness or a frontier that would serve as a crucible to prove your masculinity and make you into a real man. That was kind of the underlying philosophy of Roosevelt. And, you know, he set up all these national parks. He also, you know, wasn't just about conservation, or rather he wasn't just about preservation, but conservation. And so there was also this idea of like the rational management of our natural resources and extraction and that didn't really like fit in with the the story of nature as this pristine and natural place where like you go for spiritual and moral development. But how did it get feminine? I think we talk about this in the show a bit. I don't want to put too fine a point on it because it's not just her, but Rachel Carson is a really important part of the story. So the modern environmental movement is pretty different from the turn of the 20th century version, in that it was really a reaction to the pollution and kind of like degradation of our air and water, which we had kind of ignored for the first half of the 20th century. And, you know, Carson's book, Silent Spring, was the first really major book to challenge the primacy of the chemical industry and of like big agriculture and their use of pesticides and insecticides, which were sickening people, which were killing tons of wildlife. And the chemical industry freaked out because this was a really serious attack on their business, and people were starting to ask questions, and there were hearings in Congress, and people were writing all these letters saying, you know, we need to stop using these products. So they did a really good job of casting Carson as this kind of like hysterical woman and of opposition to their products as a form of hysteria. And that talking point has really continued into the age of the climate crisis. You'll see this all the time from the right. You know, Greta is often called hysterical, especially when she was younger. And it was a good way to kind of dismiss her without directly attacking her. And the climate hysteria movement, it's something that they repeat all the time as a way of discrediting the reasonable emotional reaction that people have to the slow burning of our planet. And it is a way to kind of like combine two strands in one, and to make people who engage in climate protests or who call for significant changes to the way we're living, it makes them seem irrational, and it dismisses them without really having to engage with the realities of their points. And yeah, I think we've basically been living in the post Rachel Carson world where the chemical industry kind of like set the template and the fossil fuel industry embraced it. There have been points where fossil fuels have said like, oh, you know, women are, you know, important to our business. And like at various times during the Biden presidency, I remember, I think it was Shell, maybe it was BP, that was like all of these, you know, like women are part of the energy workforce. And like they'll kind of genuflect to that when they think they need to. But the second Trump came in 2024, the ads were like, America's back, baby. And like the women disappeared. So for the most part, yeah, the fossil fuel industry is really happy to like stick with like, you're a hysterical woman, like stop worrying. That's pretty effective for them.
Do women drive cars? We don't know. And frankly, we don't want to know.
One thing that I also wanted to ask about, and you gestured toward it with the Elon Musk nonsense of trying to escape to space, but for those who accept that climate change is real within the manosphere, what are the other things? Obviously, there's kind of like the tech bullshit solution, which is very characteristic of the age, that don't worry about it. Some genius AI is going to figure out how to solve climate. There's the space one. And
right.
What else?
This is one of the best. This is my favorite one because there's not even a proposed solution. It's just, we'll figure it out. Don't worry.
Yeah,
we'll figure it out.
Yeah, there are certain technologies.
But yes, there's all these other things. There's prepperism. There's all these other kind of solutions. But my favorite one is the, you know, magic technology will save us in the future that we don't know what it is, but it'll happen.
When really all you need to do is subscribe to American Prestige.
That's correct. Yes.
So Derek, you just mentioned, I'll save start like planet. Small and I'll go big. So one solution that's popular in the manosphere is absolutely prepperism and survival training and, you know, kind of like having your bunker with your beans and your guns, and like that's going to get you through any sort of apocalypse, be it a climate apocalypse or, you know, they like to fantasize about zombie apocalypses. I don't know what that's about. So that's like one level is people are just like, I, as an individual, am going to use my resources and protect myself and my family. Obviously, this doesn't really work very well because, like,
I don't know, man. Like, eating beans all the time is pretty feminine. That's vegan shit. Like, I don't
They've
know,
got their
man.
Jerky too.
I don't know about but, that,
dude. And,
well, okay.
And they're gonna hunt.
Some of the most popular self-published novels are these zombie apocalypse things. Like, no publisher. You know, they're just released on Amazon, but they sell so many copies. It's like this substrate of American men.
Yeah. They're very worried about zombies. They should turn their attention to climate. So that's like one corner. I think a lot of the manosphere either just kind of shrugs and says like climate isn't happening, or it's not that big a deal, or it's too expensive to do the changes that we need to do. So I guess we're just going to keep going as is. Like that's kind of one corner of it. And then there are the technologists who think, you know, we would we call them, or they call themselves eco-modernists, who have different technologies that they favor depending on their particular connection. So like nuclear, you know, people are going crazy pushing nuclear, even though nuclear is a very inefficient way of generating power and it's extremely expensive. And then you still have like the nuclear waste. I'm not going to say like I'm totally anti-nuclear. I'm not, but I think it's the least good option and everyone is obsessed with it. Because I haven't quite been convinced on that one. So there are the nuclear people, and then there are all of the carbon capture people, and that kind of is a few different technologies. There's carbon capture where they're just like sticking, imagine like a hose on top of a giant industrial exhaust and like taking the carbon that would be emitted and just sticking it somewhere. But you're still burning oil and gas and still releasing some carbon and a lot of other pollutants in the process. So that there's that. Which is going crazy in Louisiana right now. We interviewed Mike Levien, who's a sociologist at Johns Hopkins, about his work down there. And then there are the truly nutty people who are just like, we're going to suck the carbon out of the air. It's called direct air capture, DAC, which is a totally unproven technology. There were some experiments up in, I think it was Greenland or Iceland, that completely failed after like a year of trying to get it to work. And people love to kind of push that as the solution, one of the crazy solutions. There's geoengineering. A lot of guys are into geoengineering. You know, we'll just seed the clouds with sulfur or something else, and that'll dampen the sun, and therefore the planet won't warm as quickly.
Oh, that, what could go wrong? I mean, that sounds like
haven't you guys seen The Matrix? Like,
God.
Yeah. There was also a Simpsons movie thing, right? That was like Mr. Burns' evil plot, right?
No, that was an episode.
He's like, man longs to destroy the sun.
Man, since the dawn of time, man has yearned to destroy the sun. So this is the capstone of the incoherence, right? Because it's the same guys who think that scientists are all nerds who want to take their coal rolling pickup away and you know are not manly enough to be listened to. Turning around and then saying, science, save us with your magic powers. Like, it's completely incoherent to me.
It's not the same guys. They're just on the same team. I should clarify that.
Excellent.
Because, yeah, for some of them, it's like, I don't, you know, shut up, nerd. Like, I don't care about this. This isn't real. And, interestingly, there are a lot of the people who are against the carbon capture pipelines, which are like kind of dangerous because if you leak carbon, you can asphyxiate people. It's quite serious. And it's also like giant infrastructure getting built in sensitive wetlands and like all these things. So there are environmental justice groups who are against it. And then there are also a lot of like kind of like right-wing guys who are like, climate change isn't real. You've been telling me like climate change is BS. And now the oil and gas industry is saying we need to like build these carbon pipelines in my backyard. Like, that's not going to, I'm against it. I'm not for that. So you can find some interesting political alliances forming. It's not just like all one or all the other. And I think like those people show that like you can peel guys off of this. Like it's not like this kind of, it's not baked in yet that if you believe masculinity is important to you, that you have to be a climate denier. And that's kind of what we're getting at in the fourth episode of the mini series, is like, there are alternatives. There are other ways of being a man. And there are definitely ways that you can like still be a dude and care about the habitability of our planet.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. So what are the ways to quote unquote integrate these various identities into the climate movement? And why do you think that's important? Because some might say like, this is a lost community, who gives a shit. And not only that, public opinion doesn't really matter to any of this. It's just business running everything. So why does this, why do these people matter in terms of public opinion, and then why, or really how to integrate them, quote unquote?
So I would say, you know, they do matter. And the oil and gas industry is very consciously targeted men with climate denial messaging since the late 80s, because they recognize them as having been, you know, particularly susceptible to it, and a useful like wedge to drive so that there wouldn't be social consensus around climate regulations in the early 90s, which were like about to happen with the Rio Earth Summit and with a few other international treaties that were like just around the bend. And the oil and gas industry freaked out and thought like, okay, we need to like divide people up and who's like most susceptible to our bullshit. And it's turns out it was men, particularly non-college educated men. And, you know, so how do we reintegrate these guys? I think we talk about a few different ways in the show. One is just like finding guys who are already, you know, maybe interested, but like not doing anything, right? So that's like those are the low hanging fruit. We talked to this activist who started this group called Climate Dads, which I thought was interesting in that it's really kind of just focused on like local community level or like city level stuff, but it's been quite effective in getting men to kind of like take their nerdiness or like their kind of like their dadness and apply it to climate solutions. So it's like, you want to save money? Like, are you worried about, you know, energy costs in your house? Like, let's talk about heat pumps. Like you know, there are so many dads who like, if you go to their house and like, you want to see my heat pump? Like, check this baby out, like patting it. That's like kind of the Hank Hill type, I guess you could imagine, right? There, I think also like we got to find candidates politically and sort of spokespeople who aren't so unappealing to this demographic. You know, as we said in the beginning of the show, like Joe Rogan's audience is wide and varied. It's not politically coherent or ideologically consistent. And there are a lot of guys who are interested in, you know, being men, but they don't really have an opinion about climate necessarily, or like Andrew Schultz, or, you know, a lot of these guys, like they're just kind of there to joke around and kind of bullshit essentially. And if you can get like effective messengers out there who can, you know, show like, yeah, I care about the climate, like, and it's kind of lame to not care. I spoke with this this kind of like lefty bodybuilder, Colin Davis, who has gotten more and more involved in climate stuff. And I found him to be a particularly interesting like confluence of a lot of these different strands, where, you know, he's putting out a lot of kind of like anti-right-wing fitness stuff on the one hand, and then also he was involved in, you know, the campaign to prevent the sale of public lands. And, you know, there are a lot of guys, even who aren't like explicitly leftist, who got involved in that campaign, who were kind of non-ideological. These were, you know, outdoors influencers and hunters and like men who didn't necessarily vote Democrat, even, who were quite vocal in their opposition to that campaign. And I think And I think that showed like there are ways to invite those guys back into the climate movement or into the environmental movement. And I think the last bit is, we talked to Senate candidate Abdul El-Sayed, who's running for Senate in Michigan. And he's someone who I think, I mean, one, he's like, he's a bro, you know, so he's a credible messenger. Like, he can bench 350, you know, so for the guys who are like concerned that, you know, they don't want a wimpy political candidate, or they find it appealing that someone can kind of do this like display, great, fine. Like, he can outbench RFK if that's what you need. But also, his focus is really like, it's not about climate. It's about kind of like the environment in where you live. It's about air quality. It's about water quality. Like, the things that directly affect people, like, that's what gets people to the polls or moves the needle. It's not like how much CO2 is in the atmosphere, because that's such like an abstract and kind of wonky issue. So I think like there's no one silver bullet, and there's no like, we need to make the Joe Rogan of the left. I hate that.
Well, that's us, so problem solved.
Yeah. Sorry, actually, you guys already have that crown. I shouldn't contest that. You're the alphas here. And
don't forget it.
But yeah, it's like, it's a bit of everything, right? And I think right now we're in the testing stage. Like, you kind of need to throw it all at the wall and see what sticks.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, check out Carbon Bros, I imagine, on any podcast app you would like, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great talking with you guys.
Columbus State Community College is a place that changes lives. A college that opens doors to well-paid careers in healthcare, engineering, IT, and more. An affordable college that offers the flexibility to balance work, family, and school. An open, supportive college where more than 40,000 students every year get education to improve their lives. Columbus State, the smart choice for what's next. Spring semester starts January 19th. Apply today at cscc.edu.